Hi, this is Ted, and for the next hour, you'll be listening to a reading of articles and features from the Monday, October 13th New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And we'll start with this front page article. Black workers are cast aside in policy shifts. By Lydia DePillis. Joblessness for black workers is rising again, 2 years after reaching a record low. It's a troubling indicator. Joblessness often spikes higher for historically marginalized groups during economic downturns and takes longer to fall. This time, the Trump administration's assault on diversity programs and cuts to the federal workforce could make it even more difficult for black workers to recover when conditions improve. The African American unemployment rate has surged over the past 4 months from 6 to 7.5%, while the rate for white people ticked down slightly to 3.7%. On top of a slowing economy, the White House's actions have disproportionately harmed black workers, economists said. I think the speed at which things have changed in such a dramatic fashion is out of the ordinary, said Valerie Wilson, who directs the program on race, ethnicity, and the economy at the Economic Policy Institute, a left-leaning think tank. There's been such a rapid shift in policy rather than something cyclical or structural about the economy. At least since the 1970s, when the federal government started tracking unemployment by race, the rate for black people has run about twice the rate for white people. Because of inferior educational opportunities, the legacy of mass incarceration and discrimination over generations, black people confront greater challenges in the job market. A strong economy during President Trump's first term created more jobs for black workers, but many of them were lost when the COVID-19 pandemic hit in-person employment particularly hard. Generous public subsidies, though, cushioned the blow, and hiring rebounded quickly. In 2023, conditions for black workers looked as healthy as ever. Unemployment reached a low of 4.8%. Wages rose at their highest pace since data collection began in the 1990s, and median black household wealth reached the highest level on record. Conditions started to deteriorate in 2024 after pandemic-era subsidies expired. Hiring slowed and high prices weighed heavily on low-income earners. Black households were the only racial group last year in which median income fell and the poverty rate rose, according to the Census Bureau. I was hoping that the commitment to investing in America so that a broader set of Americans were actually receiving benefits in terms of low unemployment and higher wages would continue, said Dedrick Asante Muhammad, president of the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, a think tank focused on issues affecting black Americans. He said he was particularly disappointed in large businesses that said they would support black workers in response to protests for racial justice in 2020, only to pull back. Job losses are concentrated among black women working in professional services such as human resources, according to Ms. Wilson's analysis of federal data. A hiring freeze and mass layoffs in the federal workforce, which have continued during the government shutdown and now exceed 200,000, have also fallen disproportionately on black workers. The hiring freeze is an impediment to young workers trying to get their foot in the door. The federal government is one of those places people are able to get an entry-level job, said Gbenga Ajilore, the chief economist at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, which researches the social safety net. That's a whole industry that's closed to new hires. State and local governments have picked up some of the slack from federal agencies, but competition for those jobs has gotten tougher with more laid-off public sector workers looking for positions. Cheryl Marshall, 26, who graduated from the University of California, Davis, a few years ago with a degree in psychology, has worked in Los Angeles for a rental car company and a homeless shelter, but both let her go, and she is still looking for a position that would put her education to use. It's always like high labor, low paying jobs, nothing sustainable, said Ms. Marshall, who works at a farmer's market on the weekends and is building up a freelance social media marketing portfolio between filling out applications. It's harder for me to get more technical and higher skilled jobs despite being qualified. Ms. Marshall recited her qualifications in a 30-second pitch during a job fair with city agencies last week at the Los Angeles Black Workers Center, where she also volunteers. The nonprofit has pushed local governments to hire more Black workers because unionized public sector jobs have historically provided an on-ramp to stable employment. The federal backlash against diversity, equity, and inclusion practices may be making it more difficult for Black workers to get hired in the private sector, too. Some of the strongest evidence for the efficacy of these practices, such as making sure to interview non-white candidates or reaching out to Black and Hispanic students, comes from federal contractors. In one of its first actions, the Trump administration ordered that group not to pursue racial equity anymore. Janelle Beloved Jenkins, co-executive director of the Los Angeles Black Workers Center, tries to build relationships with employers who say they are swamped with applicants. A lot of people get their jobs through networking, Ms. Jenkins said. Part of our role is to create the programs that will create the network that connects highly skilled, qualified workers to employers who might not have initially seen them. Lower interest rates could offer some relief. Representative Ayanna Pressley, Democrat of Massachusetts, wrote to Jerome Powell, chair of the Federal Reserve, in early September, demanding that the central bank take stronger action to support full employment for Black workers. Fed officials lowered rates later in the month for the first time this year and suggested that more cuts were likely. But Trump administration actions beyond workforce cuts and anti-DEI policies could create additional hurdles for Black workers. The Department of Labor's proposed rollback of minimum wage and overtime protections for domestic workers, for example, would hurt their incomes. Home care aides for older people are overwhelmingly Black and Hispanic women. And despite Trump's claims on the campaign trail that the immigrants take jobs from Black people, rising joblessness among Black workers suggests that mass deportations of migrants have not arrested the trend. Brittany Alston, director of the Philly Black Worker Project, said expelling immigrants harmed the local economies in ways that hurt Black workers too. We know that an injury to one deeply is an injury to all, she said. Here's an interesting article by Katrine Benhold, in which she interviews Peter Baker, who is one of my favorite reporters and who covers the White House. She says, President Trump is using American power in ways none of his modern predecessors have done, and the consequences are being felt around the world. Old certainties are crumbling, enemies are suddenly friends, and longtime allies worry deeply about the state of U.S. democracy. My New York Times colleague, Peter Baker, brings decades of experience to assessing the impact of the second Trump presidency. He has covered the past six presidents going all the way back to Bill Clinton. He also spent 4 years in Moscow chronicling the rise of Vladimir Putin. For the World Newsletter, that's this column, he answered readers' questions, which have been lightly edited for length and clarity. First question from Peter Schwanz from Germany. Do you think that covering Trump extensively is actually playing into his hands, as it gives him the attention he craves? The answer. He keeps us busy, no question about it. In Washington, it's called flooding the zone. There's a natural inclination to cover actions more than words because they have real-life impact, and words may only be bluster. But a president's words carry great power and can be revealing of attitude and can lead to actions. We try to focus on comments that are indicative of what he thinks and where he may be taking the country. I don't think that ignoring him is the best way to handle it. Next question. This is from Ellie O'Donnell in Ireland. Over your career reporting on presidents, have you noticed a change in the personalities you've dealt with? From the outside perspective, there's a sense of U.S. politics deteriorating. Answer. The personalities have changed in part because the incentive structure has changed. When I started covering the White House in 1996, it was a pretty combative and divisive time too, but there was still a built-in incentive to work across the aisle to get things done. Today, that has changed. Because of the widespread gerrymandering of congressional districts, the fragmentation of traditional media, the proliferation of social media, and deepening polarization, elected officials no longer see much political reward in reaching out to the middle. In fact, it's the opposite. They risk backlash if they are seen as bipartisan. The only way most members of Congress can lose is if they anger their own political base. So that discourages cooperation, and the system now attracts more firebrands than conciliators. Udo Verda from Germany asks, what makes Trump's foreign policies different from his predecessors? Is it just a bunch of provocations, or is there a long-term plan? Answer. There's a tendency in journalism to look for the hidden strategy behind a president's actions because we assume there must be one. With Trump, though, it's often as much about his own gut instinct as any overarching strategic thinking. His gut tells him that the old international order created by the U.S. after World War II is somehow tilted against the U.S., and that previous presidents of both parties have let other countries, allies and adversaries alike, take advantage of America. For Trump, that's a core conviction that goes back decades. He does not value traditional alliances, and he admires autocrats because strength, or the appearance of strength, is all important to him. While it's probably too simple to call his views isolationist, because he has exhibited some fairly imperialistic ideas, like takeovers of Greenland or the Panama Canal, his slogan, America First, does capture his attitude pretty well. Sylvia Tan from Malaysia asks, America has always championed itself as a beacon of democracy and freedom. What do you observe about Trump's role in upholding these values domestically and internationally? Peter Baker responds, President Trump does not subscribe to the traditional views of democracy and freedom held by most modern presidents of both parties. He tried to overturn a free and fair election that he lost. While out of power, he called for termination of the Constitution to return him to power. He regularly teases the idea that he would unconstitutionally try to stay in office beyond a second term. Since taking office again, he has sought to stifle the free press and openly used his power to target political opponents. He has not shown any interest in promoting democracy or human rights around the world. To the contrary, he has embraced the likes of Putin, President Xi Jinping of China, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia, and President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi of Egypt, whom he called my favorite dictator. He said he would not lecture other countries about their internal policies. Venezuela and Brazil seem to be exceptions. The question is whether other countries see all this and are encouraged to retreat from democracy themselves. Here's an interesting article that you're not likely to hear elsewhere. It's called Help from Above Aims to Save Mexico Forests from Avocado Craze by Emiliano Rodriguez Mega. When word of a new plan to help save forests reached Juan Gabriel Pedraza, an indigenous leader in Mexico's avocado heartlands, He feared the worst. They're going to screw us over, he remembered thinking. Rumors had spread that his town's orchards could be blocked from the market, a devastating outcome for residents. Avocados had helped over 1,000 families climb out of poverty. Forest loss was nothing new, having long ago transformed Western Mexico, the world's primary supplier of avocados. U.S. demand for the fruit has been devouring that forest for years. Anyone trying to slow the deforestation, nearly all of it illegal, has faced a wall of opposition. Criminal officials and others have been involved in setting fires to clear land for new orchards and reaping profits from them. Now a new scheme using satellite imagery and public pressure has confronted industry giants and small growers alike with a choice. They can stop expanding into recently cleared forests, ensuring their fruit remains eligible for the biggest U.S. buyers, or they can deforest more land for cheap new orchards, risking being cut off from a $2.7 billion annual trade. Mr. Pedraza said that his town, the Purépecha community of Xicuintho, understood the bind between the wilderness and business better than most. The forest lives within us, he said, but protecting the forest is a lot of work and takes a lot of money. Americans' appetite for avocados has made the industry extremely lucrative. It employs nearly 390,000 people across Mexico, and everybody wants a cut, including drug cartels that extort growers and clear forests, according to farmers and U.S. authorities. Everyone in this business is in it for the money, not the environment, said Herberto Padilla, the 36-year-old general director of Guardian Forestal, the nonprofit that developed the new monitoring system. Mr. Padilla saw firsthand how, since the U.S. market opened to Mexican avocados in the 1990s, growers had razed the pine oak forests around his mother's hometown in the state of Michoacán. Experience in all these abuses makes you very angry, he said. So I was like, well, how do we stop this? Earlier proposals to stop the destruction have largely failed, bogged down by corruption, industry interests, or lack of political will. The new program stands apart, Mr. Padilla and his allies say, by using satellite imagery to assess deforestation and keep an up-to-date map of certified and flagged orchards available for anyone to see. They argue the risk of being publicly marked by the platform, showing American consumers who uses deforested land, can motivate better behavior. Fear is what drives us, he said. It's the Big Brother effect, said Alberto Gomez Tago, a biologist who helped design the system. I'm watching you. The program launched last year with help from Michoacán's state government, but while officials sometimes inspect sites and flags, the system is operated by Guardian Forestal and independent auditors that double-check its findings. To get certified, an orchard cannot use land deforested since 2018 or affected by wildfires since 2012. It also cannot face accusations of environmental harm or be inside a nature reserve. When an orchard is flagged, the system blocks it from being used by allied packing houses. So far, Guardian Forestal has blocked nearly 2,200 avocado orchards of the 53,000 it has surveyed. The program also certifies packing houses, which must exclusively take avocados from compliant orchards. After three strikes, houses lose their stamp of approval. The system's power also comes from a factor outside its control, external pressure from buyers and activists, including through the courts. The program also certifies packing houses. Oh, by the way, you're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The system's power also comes from a factor outside its control, external pressure from buyers and activists. Independent of the nonprofit, the Organic Consumers Association, a U.S. advocacy group, last year sued four American importers that dominate the industry. The group accused them of making misleading sustainability claims as they sold avocados harvested from illegally deforested lands. One of the lawsuits involving the company Westpac was settled in a confidential agreement. The other three remain unresolved. We are not utilizing or picking from any ranches identified or flagged by the Guardian Forestal platform, said Delaney Beeson, a senior manager at Mission Produce. Westpac and the other companies either declined to comment or did not respond to inquiries. Nearly 30 packing houses are now certified, including the four American giants, in total accounting for about 84% of all Mexican avocado exports to the United States. The system could offer lessons for others, said Daniel Wilkinson, a senior policy advisor at Climate Rights International. One of the most urgent challenges now, globally, is finding ways to clean up the agricultural supply chains driving deforestation. Michoacán is providing a model of how to do it. Before the new program, packing houses only complied with pest control criteria demanded by U.S. and Mexican authorities. We didn't investigate who had cut down trees and who hadn't, said Mari Carmen Villaseñor, who oversees harvest operations for Mexico's largest house, Astacabo. Once American companies joined the certification program, a domino effect followed among Mexican suppliers. Astacabo, which ships 2,000 tons to the U.S. every week, was one of them. Important customers from abroad are saying, hey, I don't want you to bring me avocados from deforested areas, said Jose Antonio Villaseñor, the company founder and Ms. Villaseñor's father. This is in the avocado industry's best interest, he said, because the climate is changing and the region will cease to be productive altogether. But while pressure from U.S. buyers proved persuasive to many, smaller growers, like those in Siquixó, were outraged by the apparent threat to their livelihoods. In November, Mr. Pedraza and hundreds of other producers went to the state capital, Morelia, demanding answers. They found a handful of scared officials and Mr. Padilla, the nonprofit director. First, Mr. Padilla explained, he wasn't with the government, allaying their fears of corruption and bureaucratic meddling. Then he outlined the new certification and showed them a map of their 1,200 orchards. All but one were free of recent forest loss. He persuaded the growers to get 300 orchards certified and to contribute about $90 per hectare to an environmental trust fund managed by a bank. The group set their own condition. The money had to go back to Siquixó to support its conservation efforts. The community will use some of those funds, Mr. Pedraza said, to buy a backhoe excavator to help restore degraded soil and build fire breaks. Other figures remain critical of the program, including environmental activists who call it too lax and growers who call it too onerous. Some inside the industry feel it's unjust that such a program has power over major companies without giving them a say. We don't have to have the last word, but we do have to be taken into account, said Ernesto and Carolyn, a prominent ecologist and spokesman for Mexico's powerful Association of Avocado Exporters. The association and the federal Mexican government are devising a rival certification program, part of an effort to make all agricultural exports deforestation-free by 2030. That mandatory plan, set to start next year, would ban exports from land deforested from 2025 onward and be regulated by the government. A spokeswoman with Mexico's agriculture ministry said orchards would be inspected twice a year and algorithms would be used to identify possible deforestation. But that effort, too, has its skeptics, including Governor Alfredo Ramirez Bedoya of Michoacán, a supporter of the Guardian Forestal system. If you release a certification that only looks good on paper, then good for you, he said. But soon it will become clear how weak it really is. Mandating new industry rules, he said, would spark intense resistance and a host of legal challenges. He attributed the success of the nonprofit's program in part to the fact that it was driven by buyers. Its strength doesn't come from the state or the law. It comes from the end consumer. It's too soon to say whether the program has helped slow deforestation, experts say, but it has had a chilling effect in some areas, said Julio Santoyo, an environmental activist. In Madero, where he lives, loggers no longer seem as eager as they once were to slash the forest for avocados. The hesitation is already noticeable. Elsewhere, deforestation persists. Last month, a group of government inspectors arrived at a clearing guided by a Guardian Forestal alert. Stumps and a few forgotten logs lay beside the glossy leaves of avocado plants. Just look at the deforestation, said Guillermo Naranjo, a federal environmental inspector in the state of Michoacán. A total of 126 trees, his men counted, had been felled for illegal avocados. Moments later, his team hung a banner on a small warehouse with bright red lettering that read, "Closed." And here's another environmental story. This is called "Terminating Solar for All Dims Chances to Trim Bills" by Maxine Joselov. When Jennifer McCoy entered a drawing for the free installation of solar panels in her home, she was desperate for help with electric bills that have soared to more than $500 a month. So Ms. McCoy, 39, was disappointed when the drawing was abruptly canceled. And as a supporter of President Trump, she was shocked by the reason. His administration had revoked $7 billion in federal grants intended to help low and moderate income families get access to solar energy. I like a lot of Trump's outlooks on things, but there are some things like the solar panels that I don't like now that I know, she said in an interview outside her home in Adairsville, Georgia, a town of roughly 4,900 people, about halfway between Atlanta and Chattanooga, Tennessee. In Georgia and across the country, electricity bills have skyrocketed in recent months. Yet Trump has rescinded billions of federal dollars for renewable energy like solar and wind power that could reduce the strain on working class households. And the cuts are dealing disproportionate blow to the Republican-led states that propelled him back to office. The Solar for All program is a prime example. Established by the 2022 Inflation Reduction Act, the program was designed to help more than 900,000 households get access to solar energy. The idea was to reduce the use of fossil fuels, the leading driver of climate change, while also helping participating households to save an average of about $400 annually on electric bills. While Trump has often called renewable energy spending a green new scam, even veteran energy analysts were surprised when the Environmental Protection Agency terminated Solar for All. They had assumed that the initiative would be safe from repeal because Republican-led states like Alabama, Georgia, and South Carolina had sought or received funding. This program was the rainbows and puppies of clean energy. It was truly apolitical, said Andy Posner, the founder and chief executive of Capital Good Fund, a nonprofit group that provides small loans to low-income people for things like making their homes more energy efficient. Capital Good Fund leads the Georgia Bright Communities Coalition, a group of nonprofits, local governments, and businesses that won $156 million for solar for all grant, $156 million solar for all grant last year. The group planned to use $12 million from the grant to hold two randomized drawings for free solar installations for up to 900 low-income Georgia households. On Monday, August 4th, Georgia Bright opened the first drawing. Within 24 hours, 500 households had signed up. 3 days later, the EPA announced that it was terminating Solar for All grants to all 60 recipients, including nonprofits, state agencies, and Native American tribes. Lee Zeldin, the EPA administrator, said in a video posted to social media that the program was a boondoggle that would waste billions of green slush fund dollars. The abrupt policy shift in Washington lit up the group chats of grant recipients across the country. In Adairsville, Ms. McCoy checked her phone and saw an email from Georgia Bright saying the drawing was on hold. Ms. McCoy, a single mother of three, works two jobs as an assistant manager at a tire store and as a delivery driver for Walmart. After using food stamps to buy groceries, she struggles to pay her other bills. Her monthly charges from Georgia Power, the state's largest electrical provider, was about $548 in August, the month that Solar for All was canceled. Solar panels are far less common than Trump signs in Adairsville and surrounding Bartow County, where more than three-quarters of residents voted for Mr. Trump in 2024. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Ms. McCoy said she still supports Trump because he has restricted access to abortion, which she strongly opposes, and she is still processing the president's role in scrapping Solar for All. "I never really thought about him as being the one who did it," she said, but now I've really got something to think about. On average, residential customers of Georgia Power, like Ms. McCoy, have seen their bills rise by $518 a year, or 33%, just since 2023. Georgia residents now pay among the highest utility bills in the country, trailing only Alaska, Connecticut, Hawaii, and West Virginia. Georgia Power has increased its residential rates six times in the past 2 years, largely to cover the costs of a nuclear power plant expansion that ran $17 billion over budget. But Governor Brian Kemp, a Republican, announced in May that the utility had reached a deal with state regulators to freeze rates for the next 3 years. John Kraft, a spokesman for Georgia Power, said in an email that the utility was keeping electricity affordable for our customers and that the nuclear plant expansion was a long-term investment in reliable, emission-free energy. He said the freeze would protect customers from future cost increases tied to new artificial intelligence data centers. Seth Gunning, the founder and chief executive of SunPath Solar, a solar installation company that has partnered with Georgia Bright, said higher electricity costs had spurred interest from more customers in rural conservative parts of the state. Republicans and Democrats alike pay power bills, and Solar for All certainly wasn't just helping predominantly Democratic states, he said. In lots of historically conservative parts of Georgia, there's a huge appetite out there. People are struggling. To be sure, residents in left-leaning cities like Atlanta, Decatur, and Savannah had also entered Georgia Bright's drawing for free rooftop solar panels. Among them was An Nguyen, 47, a resident of East Atlanta, whose bill from Georgia Power was nearly $470 in August. Ms. Nguyen, who founded her own tech company, lives in a 1,000-square-foot, three-bedroom house with her husband, 8-year-old son, and 6-year-old daughter. She said she was baffled by her astronomical power bill because the family does not have any extravagant appliances that would guzzle electricity. "They're robbing me blind," she said in an interview in her kitchen, which she was cooling with a fan on that 76-degree afternoon, since running the air conditioner would consume more power. Ms. Nguyen said she looked into installing solar panels without the Solar for All program, but found that it would be prohibitively expensive, with the upfront costs ranging from $12,000 to $20,000. Conservative politicians and scholars have argued that the government should not spend taxpayer money to make solar affordable for some families. They cheered when the Republican-controlled Congress passed Trump's domestic policy bill, which phased out federal tax credits for wind and solar energy. "We should have a level playing field without any subsidies for wind and solar. The wind blows for free and the sun shines for free," said Diana Fiergott-Roth, director of the Center for Energy, Climate, and Environment at the Heritage Foundation, a conservative research organization. Fossil fuels like oil and gas, however, have received lucrative federal tax breaks for decades. Representatives for the 9 House Republicans from Georgia did not respond to requests for comments. Tim Echols, a Republican member of the Georgia Public Service Commission, which regulates utilities in the state, wrote to the EPA in August to make the case for solar for all. This solar program on the chopping block, while just for rooftops, makes a lot of sense to me, he wrote. It lets folks participate who frankly would never be able to even think about a rooftop investment. Reached on Tuesday, he said, the president is doing what he feels is best for the country, and I support his effort to curb costs. In Georgia, we have expanded solar in ways that make sense. Ultimately, a court will have the final say over the fate of solar for all, and Ms. Nguyen is part of this legal battle. Ms. Nguyen is a plaintiff in a lawsuit filed last week in federal court in Rhode Island that challenged the EPA's termination of the solar for all grants. The lead plaintiff is the Rhode Island AFL-CIO, a group of labor unions that had trained workers to install solar panels following a $49.3 million grant to the Rhode Island Office of Energy Resources. The complaint accused the EPA of illegally revoking the grants without congressional approval. We're in court fighting because the EPA ripped away this program from families with no basis, said Nick Torrey, a senior attorney at the Southern Environmental Law Center, which filed the suit along with three other nonprofits. There's a lot at stake for this particular program and for the administration's power over spending decisions overall. Bridget Hirsch, an EPA spokeswoman, declined to comment. Like Mr. Zeldin, Energy Secretary Chris Wright has frequently criticized solar power as unreliable. You have to have power when the sun goes behind a cloud and when the sun sets, which it does almost every night, he said at the New York Times Climate Forward Conference in September. Solar supporters say these concerns are overblown and that improvements in batteries mean the electricity generated by solar panels can be stored for later use. Mark Thomas said that ever since he and his wife installed 14 solar panels and a battery backup system on their Savannah home in 2023, they have not experienced significant power outages. We wanted very reliable, safe power, and we got it, he said. After Hurricane Helene barreled across the southeast last fall, the Thomases were able to keep the lights on while the rest of the neighborhood was plunged into darkness for a week. Mr. Thomas, who has severe sleep apnea, also was able to continue using a machine to help him breathe at night. The Thomases participated in Georgia Bright's pilot program, which provided discounted solar panels and batteries through a lease of around $100 per month to about 100 households. Georgia Bright has still not rescheduled the drawings for free solar installations. Also on hold are three additional Georgia Bright programs that would have provided inexpensive solar panels to both homes and businesses. Alicia Brown, the director of Georgia Bright, said that while the court fight plays out, the group is trying to attract private funding to fill the void created by the Trump administration. Yes, there have been headwinds in the solar industry, but it's not a bad investment, Ms. Brown said. It's not risky, so if the right funders step into the gap, we're going to do big things. But if everyone retreats like the federal government is, it's going to be a huge setback. And now, our weekly editorial by David French. How a Trump judge exposed the Trump con. Earlier this month, a federal judge appointed by President Trump in 2019 did the worst thing you can do to Trump in a court of law. She took him seriously. She read his words, found them disconnected from reality, and acted accordingly. For a very long time, Trump and his supporters have gotten away with a double game. First, they'll cheer anything and everything that makes him a thoroughly unconventional president, from his bizarre social media posts to his extreme use of executive power, as necessary, absolutely necessary, to save the country and drain the swamp. But when Trump's unprecedented behavior meets with an unprecedented response, MAGA is aggrieved. How dare you treat him differently from other presidents, they say. The most obvious example is the sense of grievance around the former special counsel Jack Smith's indictment of Trump for his role in trying to steal the 2020 election. Trump orchestrated a fraudulent campaign to change the outcome of an election. Instead of admitting that extraordinary actions can lead to extraordinary reactions, MAGA was furious that Trump was the first former president to face a federal indictment. Time and again, the pattern repeats. When Trump is on offense, he's celebrated as a president like no other. But when he has to answer for his actions in court, he demands that he be treated as a president like any other. Trump's National Guard deployments represent another example. He's posting wildly false statements about American cities online, and then he's directing that soldiers be sent to cities governed by officials he sees as his political enemies, even though none of the historic circumstances that have justified military deployments in the past, like widespread unrest, are present. The level of violence in Portland is a far cry from the multiple urban riots of the 1960s or the Los Angeles riots of 1992, much less the riots that spread across American cities after George Floyd's murder in 2020. But when Trump faces lawsuits, he defends his deployments by leaning on the deference earned by other presidents through their responsible use of power. Because other presidents were deemed trustworthy, his representatives argue, the courts should trust Trump too. In Portland, Oregon, however, a Trump appointee said no. She refused to play Trump's game and instead held him accountable for his words. There's no deference due to a president who refuses to operate in good faith. On October 4th, Judge Karen Immergut of the U.S. District Court for the District of Oregon issued a temporary restraining order blocking Trump's federalization and deployment of the Oregon National Guard to Portland. The opinion is a model of judicial clarity. Other federal courts should read it and absorb her reasoning. To justify his deployment, Trump invoked a statute that allows him to call the National Guard to federal service in the event of an invasion, a rebellion, or danger of a rebellion against the United States, or when he is unable with the regular forces to execute the laws of the United States. According to binding precedent, a Ninth Circuit case called Newsom versus Trump, Judge Immergut is supposed to give the president a great deal of deference in defining when these conditions exist. But how much deference should you give a president who constantly lies? The right answer is that a president can forfeit judicial deference through his own conduct. In Newsom v. Trump, the Ninth Circuit also said that the president's determinations must be made in good faith. If there's no good faith, then there should be no deference. As the judge observed, at a moment of minimal activity outside the Portland ICE facility, Trump was calling Portland war-ravaged and saying federal facilities were under siege. If those statements had been true, a military deployment would be appropriate. But they're not true, and the judge is under no obligation to pretend that they are. The president's determination, she wrote, was simply untethered to the facts. The Trump administration has appealed Immergut's order, but even if the Ninth Circuit reverses her ruling, other federal courts, including the Supreme Court, should pay close attention to her analysis. In fact, we should all read her words. She sees the Trump administration clearly. The president keeps making wild statements, and his lawyers keep trying to defend them with careful arguments. Time and again, the message is the same. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. For example, in a public message on Truth Social that was reportedly meant to be private, Trump told Attorney General Pam Bondi that three of his political opponents, James Comey, Letitia James, and Adam Schiff, were guilty as hell, and urged her to prosecute, saying, "We can't delay any longer. It's killing our reputation and our credibility." In the weeks that followed, Lindsey Halligan, the interim U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Virginia, has indicted both Comey and James. Should a court consider Trump's statements relevant to the charges, or should judges evaluate only the indictments? In other words, do courts have to pretend that there's anything normal about these criminal charges? The examples keep coming. In September, a three-judge panel at the Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans ruled 2-1 that the president did not have the authority to invoke the Alien Enemies Act to remove suspected members of Tren de Aragua, a transnational gang from the United States. The majority opinion, written by Judge Leslie Southwick, a George W. Bush appointee, took pains to note exactly how unusual the president's actions were. The Alien Enemies Act had been invoked only 3 times before in American history. Each of these times, during the War of 1812, World War I, and World War II, the country was in a declared war against a global superpower. And you're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Now Trump was using the same authority against a criminal organization, not a sovereign nation, and without any declaration of war. In his dissent, Judge Andrew Oldham began with these key sentences. For 227 years, every president of every political party has enjoyed the same broad powers to repel threats to our nation under the Alien Enemies Act. And from the dawn of our nation until President Trump took office a second time, courts have never second-guessed the president's invocation of that act. All of that is certainly true. But wouldn't it be equally true to say that for 227 years, no president of any political party has invoked the Alien Enemies Act in the absence of a declared war? The court did not create that unusual condition. Trump did. Presidents have enjoyed a degree of judicial deference in part because they have earned it. Generations of good faith and fair dealing with federal courts have even created a doctrine called the presumption of regularity, where courts presume that official duties have been properly discharged unless there is clear evidence to the contrary. There is now clear evidence in the form of Trump's own words that there is nothing regular about this administration. Judge Immergut understands this reality clearly. She understands that there are traditions that predate court precedent, that predate any deference to the executive. This country, she wrote, has a long-standing and foundational tradition of resistance to government overreach, especially in the form of military intrusion into civil affairs. This is a nation, she continued, of constitutional law, not martial law. That's correct. The best way to evaluate the reasoning behind Trump's actions is to examine Trump's words, and Trump's words reveal a man who isn't just untethered to the facts, he's also untethered to the law. Dishonest presidents should be entitled to no deference at all. And I usually like to conclude by reading some letters from the editor, which I will not do this week because there are no letters from the editor. So that was a roadblock. But here is another one of these articles, an obituary of someone who died some years ago, this one in 1967, that's really interesting. It's called Violeta Parra, a genius who transformed Latin American folk music with anthems that transcended borders, by Maria Sanchez Diaz. At 7 years old, Violeta Parra found something her father had tried to keep from her, his guitar, which he kept under lock and key. She took it and began to play. Although the guitar was too big for me and I had to rest it on the floor, she said in an interview in 1954, I began to softly sing the songs that I heard the adults playing. One day my mother heard me and couldn't believe it was me. That simple act of defiance sent her career on a trajectory that would transform Latin American folk music. Parra's compositions, rooted in Chilean traditional rhymes and rhythms, became anthems that transcended cultural and national borders. Her most iconic song, Gracias a la Vida, Thanks to Life, with its signature strumming and poetic lyrics about beauty and pain, joys and sorrows, the full spectrum of the human experience, has been reinterpreted by myriad artists, including Jennifer Lopez, the country singer Casey Musgraves, Shakira, the Canadian indie rock band Arcade Fire, and the K-pop duo Davichi. Today, Parra is widely recognized as the mother of La Nueva Canción Chilena, the new Chilean song, a South American political folk music movement, although her compositions went beyond folk, including a series of Antiquecas, audacious twists on Chile's traditional cueca dance music. Her intensely dissonant song, El Gavilán, The Sparrow, which is considered her musical magnum opus, earned her comparisons to composers like Stravinsky and Beethoven. The piece, which stretches for more than 10 minutes, layers anguished vocal cries over stark guitar chords and jagged rhythmic shifts. Parra didn't rely on commercial formulas like catchy choruses. She could build a song with just one chord, as she did with Arriba Quemando el Sol, with the sun burning overhead, whose hypnotic repetitions underscored the bleak poverty in Chile's mining towns. Her melodies were simple yet moving. No solos, minimal instruments, often just a single small guitar, as in Volver a los 17 again, her haunting meditation on the rediscovery of love later in life. Parra had a jazzy sensibility and was a virtuoso in her own way, her grandson Angel Parra, who was also a musician, said in an interview. Some found her somewhat raw, untrained voice strident. Others were captivated by her solemnity in songs like Rindel Angelito, Lullaby for the Little Angel, an elegy for a dead child, yet one that presents death as a journey back to nature rather than as a tragedy. For all her recognition today, Parra's success arrived only after her death by suicide in 1967 at 49. Just as she had darkly foreshadowed in a 1964 letter to a friend, art only bears its true fruit after the cadaver of its creator is devoured by worms. Violeta del Carmen Parra Sandoval was born on October 4, 1917, in a small town close to Chillán in Chile's Central Valley, one of nine children of Clarissa Sandoval, a seamstress, and Nicanor Parra, a teacher and musician. Violeta's parents, wary of the often dissolute lifestyle of musicians, tried to keep the guitar out of her reach. But after her father died when she was 13, she and her siblings openly played music in the street for spare change or food. When her brother Nicanor moved to Santiago to study, Parra joined him, honing her craft by performing in dive bars. Nicanor saw his sister's potential. When she was in her 30s, he encouraged her to pursue a monumental mission, finding and preserving the traditional songs of the Chilean countryside. She embraced the assignment with messianic fervor, like a Joan of Arc, her granddaughter said. Carrying a guitar, a notebook, and later a 50-pound tape recorder, she began traveling by car, bus, horse, and foot to rural Chilean farms and shantytowns in search of older residents who would play and sing traditional songs for her. In exchange, she helped them with chores like peeling potatoes. Then she wrote down what she heard. Because she never received any formal musical training, she sketched pentagrams with little balls and waves that indicated the musical phrase, said a fellow folklorist in 1986. She eventually compiled about 3,000 songs, poems, dances, riddles, and sayings. She never stopped performing and recorded about a dozen solo LPs and EPs in her lifetime. Her lyrics explored love and heartbreak, nature, and rural life, death, and spirituality. She also developed a social justice sensibility, giving voice to indigenous struggles and workers' demands and denouncing political oppression. La Carta, the letter, with its catchy and brisk guitar strumming, is considered one of her quintessential protest songs. It tells the story of one of her brothers who in 1962 was imprisoned for participating in a workers' protest for better wages. One of the lyrics say, "The hungry ask for bread, the militia gives them bullets." In 1938, she married Luis Saraceda, a railroad worker. The relationship fell apart as Parra chose music over the traditional role of a housewife. She later married Luis Arce, with whom she had two more children, but she found herself under intense criticism for not fulfilling her motherly duties in 1955. When her nine-month-old daughter, Rosa Clara, died of an illness while she was on a tour in Europe. Her other children performed with her from a young age. They recalled a childhood of spotty or no attendance at school and frequent travel, but they all seemed to value their mother's calling. In 1959, she contracted hepatitis. While recovering in bed, she started painting and sculpting. Later, she sewed embroidered tapestries known as arpilleras, made of burlap, the only material she could afford. Her art features vivid colors and natural motifs of birds, trees, and flowers, and portrayed symbolic scenes that celebrated Chilean traditions like Cueca dances or peasants' strike. She hoped to have her work displayed in the Paris Museum of Modern Art, but was rejected. Some of her pieces were eventually shown in 1964 in the Museum of Decorative Arts in the wing of the Louvre. The museum said it was its first solo exhibit devoted to a Latin American artist. In 1966, she released her most consequential album, Últimas Composiciones, Latest Compositions, a tour de force of 14 original songs that included some of her most memorable pieces, such as Run, Run, Se Fue Pal Norte, Run, Run, Went Up North. The song marries a hurried rhythm with melancholic lyrics that describe Fowler's departure for Bolivia, a journey that serves as a metaphor for their final separation. That was her longtime partner. 3 months later, on February 5th, 1967, Parra shot herself. Today in Santiago, her face adorns wall murals and her songs are taught in Chilean schools. At the Violeta Parra Museum, visitors tend to flowers in a garden dedicated to her. And across the world, her influence endures. She was a genius, her granddaughter Javiera said. One of these people who touches a string that vibrates and that vibration crosses time, space, generations, and languages. And you've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. This is Ted. I hope you enjoyed it. I apologize for my Spanish pronunciations, and I will talk to you next week. Have a good week. Bye.